Case 12-7111, Trita Parsi et al. Appellant v. Dialislam Seed Hassan. Mr. Schleisinger for the appellant, Mr. Roger for the appellee.
Please, the court. My name is David Schlesinger. I represent the appellants, National Iranian American Council, which is commonly referred to as NAIAC, and its president, Dr. Trita Parsi. I have reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal. With the court's indulgence, although we've raised several issues regarding the district court's September 2012 memorandum opinion regarding discovery sanctions in our opening brief, I'd like to predominantly spend my time discussing the district court's award of forensic imaging related sanctions to Mr. Dialislam, although I would be glad to answer any questions the court has regarding any of the issues that we've raised in our opening and reply briefs. Now, regarding forensic imaging sanctions, on at least three separate occasions in three separate orders, in July 2010, in March 2011, and August 2011, and depending on how one reads it in the district court's August 2010 order, the district court set forth a very specific decisional rule regarding the circumstances under which cost obligations for the forensic imaging would be shifted from Mr. Dialislam to the appellants, my clients. Those two circumstances were: A, if in the district court's verbiage the appellants had made what were termed inappropriate edits to the Outlook calendar entries that were uncovered in the forensic imaging process, and or B, if the appellants had withheld calendar entries that were deemed responsive to the production request that Mr. Dialislam had served on my clients. In its September 2012 memorandum of opinion, however, the district court specifically found that neither of those two conditions had been satisfied. It determined that there had not been any inappropriate alterations of Outlook calendar entries, and it further determined that even though the forensic imaging process in the district court's estimation had uncovered approximately 300 calendar entries that had not been produced to Mr. Dialislam, the district court ultimately determined that those calendar entries were too immaterial to justify sanctions under the rationale that the district court had enumerated in those orders that I just mentioned. Nevertheless, for reasons that are fairly unclear, because I think the district court's language is somewhat inscrutable on this point, the district court generally found that my clients had what the district court termed to be responsibilities to produce all of its electronic devices for forensic imaging. Now, however, as this court held in Shepard v. American Broadcasting Companies, to impose those types of discovery-related sanctions under Rule 37B2A and B2C of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, the district court had to identify a specific discovery order that it had previously promulgated and that the appellants in this case had violated. It didn't do that, though, however, in the September 2012 memorandum of opinion. Now, So depending on how one views this,
there... But the court ordered you to your client to submit its server for forensic imaging, and your client falsely stated to the court that there was no server.
Well,
there was a server.
The client
also falsely stated to the court that certain computers were not relevant because they were used by interns when one was used by a key player in the events.
Well, a couple of points, Your Honor. First, I'd have to respectfully disagree with your characterization that the district court found that my client had made false statements to it. In his memorandum of opinion, it noted that any errors that my client may have committed were the result of either carelessness or lack of resources. So there were no intentional misstatements regarding those issues.
I didn't say that they were intentional, but I said that they were false. They were false, right?
Not quite, Your Honor. And the second point I had in response to your question is that in the July 1st, 2010 order, the district court ordered my clients to either produce a server or equivalent CPUs for imaging. In its September 2012 memorandum opinion, the district court retrospectively noted that the natural meaning of the term server was an exchange server. It's uncontested in this case that my clients never operated a Microsoft Exchange server for purposes of its Outlook email and calendaring functions. So as of July 2010, my clients had not made any false statements regarding servers and what they had and what they did not have.
They had a shared drive.
They had, yes, Your Honor, they had a shared drive in place at the time of the initial dispute regarding forensic imaging.
Hadn't the representation been made previously to the court that there was no such shared drive?
I have to say no, Your Honor, but the reason for that is because as of the initial phase of this dispute in July of 2010, the focus by the parties was on whether my clients operated an exchange server. And so later on in the process, as more discovery occurred, Mr. David Lislam then sought to image my client's shared drive, which from a technological perspective is functionally different from an exchange server. An exchange server is a large, I guess you would call it in terms of memory terms, device used to push email to multiple users. A shared drive is more or less a backup device present at my client's offices that would be used to depending on one's purposes, each user would have to decide how to use it. It could be used either to back up certain entries, or it could be used by a person to upload certain information so that
other people... Isn't it undisputed that it's something that should be searched and was not searched initially by your client?
It's undisputed that as of that time... You're correct, Your Honor. As of June, July 2010, it had not been searched. But the focus by the parties at the time and Mr. De La Islam's request and the district court's understanding as of September 2012, retrospectively, was that the parties were only focused on whether my clients operated an exchange server. And so regardless of how one views this analysis, whether it's under Rule 37B2C, of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure or under the law of the case principles as Judge Randolph elucidated in his majority en banc opinion in LaShawn A. v. Berry. The district court did not consistently follow the principles it had enumerated, the rule of decision it had enumerated for determining whether my client would be assessed forensic imaging related sanctions. So it's clear that, first of all, the district court didn't in its 2012 memorandum opinion specify what order had been violated. Second, as I've just noted in my colloquy with Judge Wilkins, the district court by its own terms in its September 2012 memorandum opinion found that the server as of July 2010 was an exchange server, and my clients didn't have one, so therefore they couldn't possibly have violated the July 2010 order. And they obviously couldn't have violated the final district court order from August 2011, which required them to produce a pre-December 2009 shared drive, which they produced. So the only possible order, and we don't believe it was violated, that could have been violated was the March 2011 order. So under Rule 37B2C principles, or law of the case principles, given that the district court on three separate occasions enumerated a very specific decisional rule for deciding how forensic imaging would be assessed, the district court erred as a matter of law here. Now, I'd also like to note that the district court did not address on multiple occasions, whenever my client was contesting motions to compel under Rule 37A that Mr. De L'Islam had made, the district court did not make specific findings regarding whether my client's positions were substantially justified for purposes of either Rule 37A or Rule 37B2C. You know, we agree that my clients did not specifically enumerate those arguments, or denominate them, I should say, in phraseology like substantial justification. But the clear import of what my clients were arguing is that they had positions that were substantially justified regarding each phase of the, what I would term the forensic imaging process, whether it was, as I've discussed with Judge Wilkins, they had an exchange server as of July 2010.
But the purpose of the order was to obtain complete calendar entries from Outlook, since there had been what had been alleged to be a deficient production, and the court seemingly endorsed that view that there had been a deficient production. And so whether you call it the exchange server or not, it was do whatever we need to do to image all of the computers that are going to have Outlook information on them that's complete and hopefully unedited so that that can be turned over. And that wasn't done. And I got to tell you that your client's lucky that I wasn't the district court judge, because you'd be here appealing much more severe and higher sanctions, because I think he had extreme patience in dealing with lots of misleading and false representations, and countless times where your client was trying to slice the bologna very thin as far as trying to parse what their obligations were. And I think we can take that into account when we look at the whole picture here.
I understand your position, Your Honor. As I've mentioned earlier, the district court, however, took a somewhat different view from how you, as you say, would have viewed it as a district judge, and didn't make any findings except for very limited circumstances that we addressed in our opening brief on different grounds. Didn't make any findings regarding intentional misconduct regarding the forensic imaging process. It didn't even make any findings that my client had been reckless with regard to the production of the different devices. It simply determined, and this is clear in its memorandum of opinion, that any inadvertent failure to produce shared drives at different times was a result of carelessness and lack of resources. So with that in mind, and I understand your strong views, but regarding Rule 37B2C, this court was quite clear in Shepard that a specific discovery order had to have been identified by the district court, and the district court then needed to have found that discovery order was violated for these types of sanctions, with, you know, absent any type of inherent authority findings, as this court also required in Shepard and the Supreme Court required in Chambers v. Nasco. You know, absent any kind of those findings, there simply isn't any legal basis for imposing forensic imaging sanctions on my client or shifting the cost obligation from Mr. De La Islam to my clients. And I should also note in my remaining time, Your Honor, that the district court at these different stages, you know, particularly in March of 2011 and August of 2011, could have used the rationale that you had proffered to find that cost shifting should have occurred. And particularly in August of 2011, for the first time in the case, the district court determined that sanctions under Rule 37A resulting from Mr. De La Islam's motion to compel were appropriate. But the district court at that time nevertheless reiterated its decisional rule in this case.
Let me ask you what we should, if anything, draw from the fact that in Shepard, the court was discussing the requirements in the context of a default judgment or summary judgment, as distinct from what I'll just describe for purposes of argument here, what the district court determined were discovery violations. And there is some leeway in Rule 37 in terms of authorizing the district court to impose other just orders.
I would suggest, Your Honor, and let me actually get the text of Rule 37B2. Mm-hmm. It says here, the court, if a party or a party's officer, this is B2A, director or managing agent, and then I'll omit the non-pertinent language, fails to obey an order to provide or permit discovery, and including an order under, among other things, Rule 37A, the court where the action is pending may issue further just orders. So our view, Your Honor, is that the language is quite clear and quite plain, that there has to be an existing discovery order.
But it also says an order under Rule 26F.
Right, and
under 26F is a scheduling order that's entered that sets forth the general schedule in terms of discovery, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. The district court, however, here did not make any specific findings regarding Rule 26F having been violated. As we've mentioned in our briefing, this court in Mannion v. American Airlines held that the district court had to make a specific finding regarding a specific rule for this court to be able to review that. It's not appropriate, this court held in Mannion, for this court to try to find alternative bases to affirm a district court order. Mr. De La Islam did not, before the district court, argue under Rule 26F that any of these discovery violations were sanctionable. So, Your Honor, I do know you are correct that it is mentioned in Rule 37B, but the district court simply did not make any findings regarding Rule 26F, and Mannion therefore controls and precludes this court from considering that as an alternative basis for affirming the district court.
I thought it was 16F.
I think Judge Randolph, I think you are correct. I think 16F is one of the grounds that Mr. De La Islam argued as a basis for affirming the sanctions that the district court imposed for my client supposedly having altered the frequently asked questions archive for an organization called the Iranians for International Cooperation. So in that regard, the district court did not find, by clear and convincing evidence, as is required under Shepard and Chambers, to impose inherent authority sanctions. Mr. De La Islam has argued.
Is that just for penal sanctions?
That's correct, Your Honor. Although,
were these penal? I thought I may have this confused with another part, but I thought the sanction here was just the costs of or the attorney fees incurred in bringing the motion.
That's only for certain of the sanctions, Your Honor, particularly for violating, as the district court held, the March 2011 order regarding production of the shared drive. So there weren't any findings regarding the forensic imaging sanctions. As I mentioned, there weren't any findings that a specific discovery order had been violated. For various other items that we've mentioned in our opening brief, the district court did not articulate bases under Rule 37B2A or B2C and either purported to use its inherent authority or was unclear about what it was doing. But regarding the IIC frequently asked question alteration, Your Honor, it's quite clear that the district court intended to impose a sanction for deterrent purposes and it included an award of attorney's fees. In both Shepard and Chambers v. Nasco, this court and Chambers, the Supreme Court, held that attorney's fees, particularly in Shepard, this court held that attorney's fees were penal in nature and therefore required both showings of bad faith and bad faith proven by clear and convincing evidence. That was not done here for several categories of supposed discovery misconduct.
Excuse me.
Certainly, Your Honor.
You want to finish your thought?
I have finished my remarks. Without further questions from the court, I'll reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
All right. You have no time, but we'll give you some time.
Thank you.
All right. Counsel for Appley.
H.L. Rogers for Appley Hassan Dial Islam. Here, Judge Bates properly exercised his discretion in sanctioning parties for violating numerous discovery orders and for other egregious misconduct. In the issue of the server, which the judge has been discussing, there was a July 2010 order. The judge did not order that they turn over an exchange server. He ordered they turn over a server on which the calendar entries were found. At the end of the litigation, they did eventually turn over a server on which calendar entries were found. And on page 4 of the judge's decision of his sanction order, he stated that they failed to turn that over until the very end, long after they had violated 3 successive orders from the court. Under that, it's clear that he has the discretion under Rule 37B2A in ordering just orders to sanction the parties for that violation, and not just one, but for 3 violations in the case of the server. Here they numerously, it's not that the judge came up with the word server himself, it's that the plaintiffs continually told him they had a server on which the calendar entries were found. They told him, they told the parties in a deposition by the NIAC employee they put forward as their IT expert that they had a server where the calendar entries would be located. Their outside IT specialist swore an affidavit saying that there was that NIAC had a server. The parties, when they moved for reconsideration of the July order themselves, still following the July order, when they moved for reconsideration, stated that they had a server on which calendar entries would be found. It was only after ordered in July and then in August of 2010 that they changed their story once again to say they didn't have a server, when they had been telling the parties and the judge for years that they in fact had a server on which calendar entries were found. And at the end of the day, they had not just one server, but 2 servers on which calendar entries, responsive calendar entries that they failed to produce under direct order from the court, were located. I would like to make one point on Rule 37, on the case of the calendar entries and the membership records, which led to the redeposition of Emily Blout and Mr. Parsi. In their reply brief, the appellants point to a causal argument in saying and pointing to 37B2C that the attorney's fees need to have been caused by the failure, by the violation of the order. We would point the court to 37B2A, where there is no causal link necessary, just a violation of an order, and then any just sanctions can be ordered by the court. And we believe that's what was done. Judge Bates set out the correct legal standard at the beginning of his sanctions order in September 2011. and followed that correct legal standard. And appellants do not dispute that he set out the correct legal standard at the beginning of his opinion. They only dispute with the way he wrote that opinion in various nitpicky parts of it. But the legal standard is correct, and he followed that legal standard. They violated orders, they were sanctioned for violating those orders, and they don't dispute that they violated numerous discovery orders, that they made misrepresentations to the court time and time again.
Anything further?
If there are no further questions, I'll rest.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellants.
Quickly respond to 3 points that Mr. Rogers raised. Let me direct the court to JA873, which is page 4 of the district court's September 2012 memorandum opinion. Under the heading 1 server production in line 5, and this is what I was alluding to earlier, the district court writes, quote, the term, quote, server, end quote, was not defined by the court or the parties, but the natural meaning in context was a Microsoft Exchange server. So this is what I was discussing at length earlier regarding how the focus by the parties at that early point, the genesis of this discovery dispute, was on the Microsoft Exchange server, or in as ended up being true, the non-existence of that Exchange server, which Mr. Deslam wanted to search forensically to determine if any calendar entries had been either intentionally altered or intentionally withheld from production. And so at that very early stage, when the district court first established its rule of decision regarding when forensic imaging sanctions, if at all, would be shifted, that was the understanding of everyone here. As I discussed earlier, particularly in my colloquy with Judge Wilkins, the district court never made any findings regarding intentionality, or that my client in any way falsely or intentionally misrepresented facts regarding the server issues. Now, regarding Mr. Rogers' argument regarding B2A, he's correct that in B2A, there isn't a causation requirement, but when you go to B2C, the payment of expenses for this supposed discovery violation, there is a causation requirement. And let me quote from it. Instead of, or in addition to the orders above, the court must order the disobedient party, the attorney advising that party, or both, to pay the reasonable expenses, including attorney's fees, caused by the failure, then unless there was substantial justification. So, you know, contrary to Mr. Rogers' assertion, there is a causation requirement that will apply to any Rule 37 B2A or B2C sanction the district court purported to assess. And finally, just to sum up, regarding Mr. Rogers' assertion that we did not dispute that the district court correctly characterized the Rule 37 standard, in our briefs we did note that the district court, particularly regarding its analysis on the top of page 2, JA871, in which it said Rule 37 imposes no bad faith or willfulness requirement, which is correct, but the next part of that sentence is not correct. It simply allows a court to issue any, quote, just orders, end quote, necessary to punish past discovery abuses or deter future abuses. As I've argued repeatedly, and as we've argued repeatedly in our briefs, that's not what Rule 37 permits in the discovery violation context. There has to be a specific discovery order.
All right, I think we have that part of your argument.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
We'll take the case under advisement.